Well, thank you very much, Stephen, for your generous introduction. Welcome to Sydney, ladies and gentlemen. And I too remember October of 2008 vividly. And once in a lifetime is certainly enough for that experience. But the times remain interesting 5 years on, and I'm sure that you will have a great deal to talk about today in your conference. What I'd like to do is to confine myself to some brief remarks, firstly about the global scene, and then turn to some comments about things in Australia. From this distance, at least, it appears that the US economy is healing, notwithstanding some wobbles in the data. The headwinds from the housing sector are lessening. Corporations are in a strong financial position, and the labour market is improving, albeit slowly. Much financial repair has been made, and the new sources of abundant energy in the US will also act as a growth enhancer over time. The biggest remaining problems, of course, are to find a way of putting the US budget onto a sustainable long-run path, and how to manage the exit from the extraordinary monetary measures which have been in place in recent years. In Europe, numerous downside risks that were top of mind a year ago have not in fact materialised, and that's quite an achievement. Moreover, there are some signs at the moment of a modest cyclical upturn in economic activity. That said, those downside risks in Europe haven't gone away, they're still there, and the recovery has been described by ECB President Draghi as, and I quote, weak, uneven, fragile, and starting from very low levels, unquote. China, meanwhile, has continued to grow, more or less in line with the objectives set out by the Chinese authorities. That's a more moderate pace than the double-digit growth rates that we saw some years ago for quite a long time. But it is still a robust performance, and China is now a very big economy whose performance matters a great deal to the rest of the world. The key question in China, I think, is whether the so-called shadow banking system, where much of the growth in financial activity has been occurring, can be adequately controlled and kept stable. The emerging market economies have experienced, as Stephen just said, some turbulence in recent times. Until May or so of this year, their problem was that inward flows of capital were occurring, in part resulting from spillovers from the extraordinary measures in the major countries. That put upward pressure on exchange rates, it made for easier financial conditions, and that was conducive to rising credit and asset values. It was also a permissive environment for the continuation of any underlying imbalances or weaknesses that might have been there. When the Federal Reserve began to lay out the conditions under which it would consider scaling back its extraordinary measures, and the possibility became real that such a scaling back might occur this year, markets responded by scaling back their own purchases of assets in emerging markets. The situation then became much less permissive. Financial conditions tightened, exchange rates came under downward pressure, and policymakers were faced with the need to craft responses rather quickly. That pressure, of course, abated when the Fed did not, in the end, begin the taper in September. Since then, stock markets have tended to advance, long-term interest rates have declined, and the US dollar has weakened. The outflows from emerging markets are slowed down. Even in the face of the impending deadline for the debt ceiling in the US, markets experienced relatively limited disruption, though I think it's very doubtful that they would have accepted an actual default with the same equanimity. So there was a distinctly more relaxed feeling around the meetings of the G20 and the IMF in Washington a few weeks ago than there had been in like meetings earlier in the year. But it would be a mistake to relax for very long in the face of this delay. Surely the taper will come, and in fact we should hope it does. Because if it does, that will signal that the US economy is well established on a recovery track, and it will start to lessen some of the uncomfortable spillover effects which are unavoidably associated with the present set of policies. For some countries, including Australia, the beginning of a return to something resembling more normal conditions in at least one major advanced country would lessen some of the difficulties that we face in our own policy choices. For some other countries, the taper may see some resumption of the less welcome pressures that were seen earlier this year. But the good news is we've had a dress rehearsal of what this is going to look like. So we have a sense of where the pressure points are, and we now have a window within which to address the vulnerabilities. And it would be wise for policymakers around the emerging market countries in particular to use that window. Turning then to the Australian economy, we have seen over the past couple of months evidence of a lift in sentiment in the business community. A lessening of political uncertainty, no doubt, has helped that, though we should note that this follows an improving trend in measures of household confidence that began in the second half of last year. That uptrend had a setback in the middle of this year, but then resumed. One force which has to have been helping household and business confidence, surely, has been a positive trend in asset markets. Over the past year, the Australian stock market, as measured by the ASX 200 Accumulation Index, has returned about 25%. The median price of a dwelling in Australia has risen by about 8% over the past 18 months, reversing a similar-sized decline prior to that. Overall, since the end of 2011, the net worth of Australians has increased by about 15%, or more than $800 billion. It's not yet clear to what extent or when these more favourable trends in confidence will translate into intentions to spend, invest, and employ. Certainly, the pace of new dwelling construction is starting to respond to higher prices in the established property market and other fundamentals as we need it to. But at this stage, the available information suggests that broader investment intentions in the business community remain subdued. And it may be a while yet, I think, before we can expect to see conclusive evidence of a change there. In the interim, some commentators have taken the view that the property market dynamics are worrying. And my own view, at least so far, has been that some rise in housing prices is part of the normal cyclical dynamic, that it helps to improve the incentives to build, and that a price rise that reverses an earlier decline probably isn't something to complain about too quickly. Moreover, credit growth, which is still between 4 and 5% a year to households and less than that for business, does not suggest at the moment that rising leverage is feeding the price rises in housing. Hence, it's been, in my opinion, a little too early to signal great concern. There are, however, two caveats here. The first is that notwithstanding that credit growth is low now, it may pick up somewhat over the period ahead, and therefore, as you would expect, that is a thing that we'll be watching closely. Secondly, while overall credit growth is low at present, borrowing is increasing quite quickly in some pockets. Investor participation in housing in Sydney in particular is becoming noticeably stronger. And one statistic here, over the past year, the monthly value of finance approvals for investors in Sydney has increased by about 40%. Now, we've certainly seen higher growth rates than that in the past, and it may be that some of what we're seeing is a catch-up from a delayed initial response to fundamentals that favour more investment in housing. Nonetheless, as this activity continues, lenders and borrowers alike would be well advised to take due care. It's very important that strong lending standards remain in place and that decisions, either to lend or to invest, be based on sensible assumptions about future returns. That's what we need if we are to experience a long and sustained upswing in housing investment that houses our growing population at reasonable cost and that pays a reasonable return on the capital so employed. And that's the sort of outcome that we want as part of the more balanced growth path for the economy that we're seeking over the years ahead. Another part of that balanced growth path would involve an expansion in some of the trade-exposed sectors that have been squeezed by the high exchange rate. And indeed, the foreign exchange market is perhaps another area where investors should take due care. While the direction of the exchange rate's response to recent events is perhaps understandable, that response was from levels of the exchange rate which were already unusually high. And the levels that we see at present are not supported by Australia's relative costs and productivity levels. Moreover, the terms of trade, often a big influence on the exchange rate, are likely to fall, not rise, from here. So it seems quite likely that at some point in the future, the Australian dollar will be materially lower than it is today. Now, while I'm on the exchange rate to take up one issue which has become topical in recent days, and that's the exchange rate's effect on the Reserve Bank's own balance sheet. The high exchange rate, as you would know, has led in earlier years to a decline in the value of our foreign assets and hence a diminution in the bank's capital to a level well below that judged by the Reserve Bank Board to be prudent. Now, our annual reports have made quite clear over several years now that while this rundown in capital in the face of large valuation losses was exactly what such reserves were designed for, we considered it prudent to rebuild the capital at the earliest opportunity. It's been clear that the bank saw a strong case not to pay a dividend to the Commonwealth during this period, preferring instead to retain earnings so far as possible in order to increase the bank's capital. That rebuilding could have taken quite a few years at the current low level of earnings. That's the background to the recent decision by the Treasurer to act to strengthen the bank's capital in accordance with a commitment that he made prior to the election. The effect of this is that instead of it taking many years to rebuild the capital, it will occur in the current year. That results in a stronger balance sheet on average and makes it likely that a regular flow of dividends to the Commonwealth can be resumed at a much earlier date than would otherwise have been the case. So, ladies and gentlemen, there's much for you to talk about. They're my views, but no doubt they'll be either endorsed or contradicted by all of the ensuing speakers. I wish you very well in your deliberations and thank you for your attention.